go ahead and get started. Just a reminder, I'm sure you need it, tomorrow morning, 8 a.m., Bachelor 106, we have an exam, so that's your line. I will answer questions if you have them today, between 3:30 and 5. If nobody shows, I won't hang out till 5, probably. So. If you run out of questions, fine. But whatever. And again, the spirit of this is not a review session, but I'll try to answer whatever questions you might have as fully as I can, regardless of what's on the test. Although, if you go way off base, I'll probably pull you back a little bit. And that's about something. So, any issues, questions, string calculators? I prefer pen. You definitely don't want to be erasing, because TAs do partial credit. So if you go off the deep end and do some really stupid stuff on the left-hand side, and then you get it right over here, the TA will grade the right stuff. You don't get points off of being stupid over here. Right? So you want to leave everything on there. I always get a little bit taken aback when I get an exam paper and I look and they've written a lot and it's all erased and stuff. Especially when you can tell that they erased the right thing. Then you sort of think, well, okay, Darwin at work or something like that. But all right. Anything on your mind?
Is the formula sheet ever written for it?
Your formula sheet?
No, I mean the formula sheet can be written for this.
I sent it to you earlier. It's written on the tablet PC.
So the sheet that we just seen sounds exactly the same.
Yeah, that's exactly it, except it will be copied by a copier and attached to the back of your exam. Some students like detaching the formula sheet from the back of the exam, which makes complete sense to me. But if you do that, don't start solving problems on that sheet of paper, because if you have a loose sheet of paper that you hand in, I mean, it's asking a lot for everybody to keep track of that. So you know, keep stuff attached. But yeah, that'll be the sheet. I didn't type it up. Anything else? So we have been talking about electromagnetic waves, and last time we spent a while looking at Maxwell's equations sort of as a review and played with some vector calculus identities and tried to look at what the essence of it is coming out of Maxwell's equations. And what we found was that Maxwell's equations, without any funky boundary conditions, tells you that you have a wave equation in B and a wave equation in E with velocity, which is related to this mu zero epsilon naught, which are constants that you can establish in the lab by making measurements of the basic electromagnetic thing. And when you look at 1 over the square root of these, you get the velocity of light. So it just pops out of Maxwell's equations that E and B are waves and they will travel at the speed of light. To really get a feeling for what's going on, though, you have to recall that Maxwell's equations isn't really an independent set of E equations and an independent set of B equations. E and B are entirely coupled in the two equations, especially the typically Faraday and Ampere law equations. So these coupled equations, E and B, get all mixed up. So in order to learn a little bit more about it, what we did last time was we looked at a harmonic wave solution, because we can, now that you're pros on Fourier analysis, you understand why I don't care that you might have a wave that's not harmonic, because I can understand the solution of it through harmonic solutions. So we assume a harmonic solution to these equations, and we use Maxwell's equations, but now we impose some boundary conditions to try to get our heads around some basic aspects of Maxwell's equations. And what we did in class last time was to impose the boundary condition that U, the observer, is very, very far away from the source. So we know that the energy flow from something that emits electromagnetic waves will go out in every direction. But if you're very, very far away, basically it will look as if what's hitting you is a plane wave. So we're going to look at it in that approximation. And then we make an assumption, which is that the electric field orientation in this wave is along the y-axis, which will be up and down. And you need to learn how to say these things properly. It's very important to your future to learn to say things fairly dryly and as intimidating as you can. So the way to say this is you say, with no loss of generality, you will assume that the electric field is oriented in the y direction. And of course that makes sense, because we could assume this way, we could assume that way, we just have to choose something for the rest of the problem. So that's what we do. And what we found when we made this assumption and we looked at what came out of the boundary conditions is that E and B are transverse to the direction of motion. They are mutually perpendicular. They are in phase. And there's a relationship between the amplitude of E and the amplitude of B in the units that we commonly use. They're related by the speed of light. So these are general aspects of electromagnetic waves coming out of the boundary conditions. The warning here is that I'm doing this because I think that's a very useful intuition for you to have. But if you solve Maxwell's equations in different boundary conditions, you might find things look different. For example, they might not be completely transverse. You might have longitudinal components and stuff like that. Okay? So just be warned, we're not going to do anything fancier with them than this in this class. So we can assume that we have a harmonic solution with no loss of generality. I'll call it the cosine. And we will say that it has, cosine kx minus omega t, so we're moving in the positive x direction. This is basically the solution we found in class last time, where we assume that E is along the y and the wave is moving along the x. So the magnitude of E changes as you go in x or in time. And B is at right angles to it. And we found if E was in the y, then B was in the z. Taking the amplitude here and multiplying it by the k over the omega basically gives you the E over C that we had in the last page. And we say it has the same frequency, it has the same phase. So here are solutions for E and B. And when you take this picture and you look at what it tells you, and we're saying that E is along the y. It has a spatial dependence, so if we freeze time and look at it, we're going to have this cosine function. The B will be also a cosine function, but it's now in the zx plane. They're in phase, so when E is at maximum amplitude, B is at maximum amplitude. Okay? And then this whole thing propagates out, and last time I think I showed you, if it's still up here, this applet to give you a sense of it. I have found sometimes students are... they misunderstand this applet in the sense that this envelope represents the magnitude of the vectors in the entire plane that's transverse to the motion. It does not represent like the envelope of some discrete photon or something. Right? So this isn't the beam. It's an entire wave, where within that wave, at that instant, you have that E and that B in terms of the magnitude of E and B in that plane. Of course, it's patently a bit ridiculous, because when you start talking about infinite planes and stuff like that, they don't really exist in real life. That's the approximation we're using. And for a source far enough away and intense enough that you can actually detect something, that's a perfectly good description. Yes?
This field that we use fields all so constant.
Sorry, I shouldn't have mentioned the P word. What's a photon? What's a particle? I don't know what you're talking about. Leave that silliness at the door. We're talking about waves here. This is not a photon. I mean, sorry, we can't say that word. You'll have to wait a few weeks before you're allowed to say that word in this class. You always have to mature into these things. And you'll find that I don't have a good answer for you in the end, because, right, I mean, you look at it this way, you look at it that way, but it's really hard to marry the two. So life is full of those things, and it may really just indicate a shortcoming in our ability to actually perceive true nature somehow. I don't know. At any rate, one of the funky things about this is, you know, we have no constraint on lambda. So lambda could be a very wide range of values, from as small as you'd like to as large as the universe, basically. And so we have a spectrum of these electromagnetic waves, where here I'm plotting it in terms of wavelength, and our eye is only sensitive to a very tiny region here. So, you optics people are missing out on all the fun. But, okay. At any rate, so very small region is what really we see. The wavelengths are a certain value. But that doesn't mean that the electromagnetic waves are limited in any way, shape, or form. Okay, it's just we don't typically perceive them. So we have to build devices in order to see them, but we have lots of regions of the electromagnetic spectrum. And we call this electromagnetic radiation. It's good to use that word because that intimidates the masses. People are like, get scared about radiation. You run into it. Radiation can be really useful stuff, right? And so I don't know. They're very scared of it sometimes. Now, one of the cool things about this is you have these different wavelengths, and different wavelengths are going to be sensitive to different size things. You can't resolve something optically with a wavelength that's vastly larger than the object that you're trying to see, right? So. And then when we get into quantum mechanics, we'll find that the energy of the P word varies depending on what the frequency is. So how these things interact with matter is dramatically different depending on the range of the spectrum that you're in, which is one of the beautiful, rich things about nature. So anyway, there is no difference between a gamma ray and a visible light, except energy and wavelength. They're the same beats. The essence of them is exactly the same. Of course, the fact that their frequency and their energies are very, very different does have massive implications for how they fit into our world, but nevertheless, the essence of them is the same. So I would like to look at the characteristics of these electromagnetic waves a bit more. But before I do that, let's convince ourselves that I'm speaking truth. What we said is that this electromagnetic phenomenon is a wave phenomenon. Period. We've seen it mathematically. I hope you believe in Coulomb's law. I hope you've actually seen, you know, two currents creating a current, creating a magnetic field around it and stuff. So this stuff is real. Maxwell's equations describes all that stuff really, really well. And what pops out of Maxwell's equations is indisputably a wave equation. Okay? So that means that these strange electromagnetic waves, which have no problem passing through a vacuum because the medium, they're sort of self-induced, so it's not like they're wiggling some medium thing so that this piece of the wave helped for that piece of the wave, like all the mechanical waves that we've seen do. Nevertheless, they're waves. So they have to exhibit superposition, interference, and all the stuff that we've seen with waves of any other sort. So we will look at optical stuff later, but for right now, let's look at microwave waves. And I'm looking at microwave waves because microwaves have a longer wavelength. And because they have a longer wavelength, things like interference and the such will have maxima and minima that vary over macroscopic distances. So you can see that microwaves can vary up to the order of, you know, almost a tenth of a meter. So I have a fairly long wavelength microwave here, microwave generator. And in this case, these are electromagnetic waves, and we're going to learn that you can manipulate electromagnetic waves by taking care of their electromagnetic characteristics. If the wave is made up of electric fields, we know we can do lots of things with electric fields. For example, if an electric field hits a conductor, electric fields don't really penetrate in the conductor, so they'll reflect. So a way to think about it is the electric field will hit a piece of metal and start moving the electrons up, which effectively will cause destructive interference at this point, and you'll get a reflected wave, perhaps. Okay, so that you can sort of think of it that way. And in this case, we have that. We have a generator here and just an aluminum plate there. And in fact, one thing I want to show you is that the waves do not penetrate metal. So here is a generator. There's an aluminum plate, which basically will reflect the waves. So this is an electromagnetic analog of the standing waves that we saw earlier in the term. And if I have a thin sheet of aluminum that's metal, if the waves have electric field components to it, they should not penetrate it. So here I have, so this is separated in space, okay, not connected, and I have basically just a piece of wire here, so it's acting as an antenna. As the wave hits it, it generates a current that gets measured. Okay, so you have more of an electric field when you see sort of a higher value here, and less when you don't. So if I put a piece of metal between the generator and that thing, you see it goes away. I lift the metal up, it's there. If I take a piece of paper and I put it there, you may get a very minor effect, but not anything. So it penetrates through stuff. Standing waves. If you have a reflection there, you're going to have basically some minima and maxima here. And I haven't really looked to see if we have serious resonance going on, but as I move this longitudinally, you'll see the value change. You'll see it fall over. Okay. So it goes back up. Out of cable. Well, if you have a good imagination, you can sort of see some minima and maxima there. Another thing that we see about electromagnetic waves is that there is, we've said there's an orientation for the electric field. And if the electric magnetic waves are interacting with the material by effectively that field interacting with the charges in the metal, for example, then you might expect that you can have, if it's a fairly large amplitude wave, which these, the generator has wires about like that, so it's going to have an amplitude something like this. If I have something that's metal that's made of a grid like this, if it's oriented this way and the electric field is like that, then you might expect it not to be able to penetrate because it literally can move the electrons up and down effectively. It'll block it. If it's this way, now the field really can't do much with the electrons in terms of relative to the amplitude of the field. You're not going to get a lot of wiggling here. And you're going to see that the microwave should be able to go right through. So, make sure that we have something very measurable here. Okay. So now I'm going to put it this way, where in principle they can wiggle the electrons up and down. And you can see that it blocks the electromagnetic wave. If I take this and I turn it this way, it really doesn't do a whole lot. Okay. We're going to look at polarization later in this class. So we call the orientation of the electric field the polarization of the wave. And this would be Polaroid sunglasses for microwaves, basically. Right, it's going to cut out one of those polarizations. Okay, everybody has to turn their head a little. And what I have here is something similar, a microwave generator, a microwave detector, and we have the microwave version of double slits here. So you've seen the water experiment and you've done some sound experiments or looked at sound problems where you have interference from two sources sending waves. You have different distances, you'll have constructive and destructive interference that will vary with angle as you go. So we should see something of that effect here. This is roughly straight on. It should, in principle, be a maximum. But notice before class that this maximum isn't as high as the maximum that we're about to hit, so don't ask me why. I have no idea. Probably has to do with the reflections off of other crap. But, so as I change this angle, we should see the we should see it reduce where we have destructive interference. So the magnitude of this current goes down. And then as we go further, the distances change more and you should begin to get constructive interference. And we see it going back up. And in fact, it goes back up higher than it was when it was dead on, which tells us we have experimental problems here. Sometimes nature doesn't problem. Then we come back down to a minimum. And now it goes back up. All right, so you get the idea. Yes?
Maybe this is sort of a naive assumption about how the detector is collecting the different points of the maximum. But if that square sort of funnel in front of it is collecting both or multiple maxima, is it possible that somebody getting one in the middle and then getting both that middle one, the next one out and start to rotate it?
There might be something strange happening like that. I don't know. I didn't take time to play with it before class or calculate it based on the wavelength to see exactly what I expect. But I'm not too worried about it because you saw the maximum minimum, right? So you have basic interference pattern of this thing going in and out. So before we publish, we'll make sure we sort that out. So, all right. Do you believe? Do you? Right? Do you believe? They're waves. It's waves. It is. All right. So we have waves. Crap. My best laser pointer is not working. Okay. So one of the cool things about waves is that they carry energy. Why do you care?
You like to warm your food.
Yeah. It'd be really one cold planet if we didn't get any energy coming from light and the sun and stuff like that. So it's a very big deal that these waves can carry energy. And so I want to look at that for a moment. So let us imagine we have the solution that we've found with the E and B oriented along Z and Y, and this wave is moving in the X direction. And let's draw a box in this plane, which is dx thick, or along x. And recall, I'm not going to remind you or prove it to you because you were all pros having had 122 or 142 or whatever. So the energy density in an electric field goes epsilon naught over 2 times the magnitude of the electric field squared, instantaneous. Right? And the energy density in a magnetic field goes as 1 over 2 mu naught times the magnitude of B squared. So if we ask what is the energy in this differentially thick plane box, then it would be, the amount of energy in that volume would be the energy density in the electric field plus the energy density in the magnetic field times the volume of this box. Okay? So we rewrite what those energy densities are, and we say that we have some area for this box and its thickness dx, so this would be the volume of the box. And remember that E and B are related by this factor C. And we found earlier that the speed of the wave is related. I think that should have an equal sign there. So we can substitute in for one of the E's here and one of the B's here and make these two terms basically identical and pull them together. And when you do that, you end up with this, where the differential energy in that box of area and thickness dx, because it's 1 over mu naught C times the magnitude of E times the magnitude of B at that moment. And now if I take the derivative of both sides with respect to time, this dx over time becomes the speed of light, which is C. The du over time is how the energy is changing with time in this box. So that's a power in the box. And these things
just follow.
So if I take the area aspect of it and I ask, what is the power flowing through that area? Then I get this constant 1 over eb over mu, because these two c's cancel. Power per unit area, watts per meter squared, that is intensity. Right? So in light, that's the intensity. And the thing to notice is it goes as the magnitude of the amplitude of E times B, But of course, we know that E and B are pretty easily related, so we can rewrite this in terms of just E squared or B squared. So, kinds of problems you run into for qualifying exams and stuff, or maybe tests in this class or something, would be what would be the intensity of the electric field on average for sunlight? For sunlight, right? So you use, I can give you the power output of the sun. You can look at the distance and determine what the intensity is at the surface of the Earth, and from that you can get the electric field magnitude. Yeah, so scales is the area of the sphere. You okay? You're bored. You've seen all this? No? You should look so bored. I will have to speak loudly. Okay. So,
I don't guess that works. That doesn't make me more exciting to speak loudly. Have you ever noticed, I mean, I go overseas a lot, and I go to Japan where I'm completely illiterate, right, when I go there. And I catch myself doing this sometimes, and I think, what an idiot. And when somebody doesn't understand what you're saying, and you're trying to do something, you say the same thing, and you say it louder. Like that's supposed to make a difference. Okay, so one of the things to notice is the wave is propagating, and remember, we started with the traveling wave going in the positive x direction. So the direction of the energy flow for this solution is in the positive x direction. E and B are always perpendicular. They're in phase. So E cross B is always going to have the same direction. So E cross B, you guys remember the cross product, right? Fingers along the first one, E, curl it in B in the plane that contains the two. And your thumb gives you the direction of the cross product. So the energy in the electromagnetic wave flows in the direction of E cross B. And if we had solved for this wave going the other way, we'd have found the orientation of E and B such that E cross B would be like that. Okay? If I wait for a half a period, E is down, B is that way, E cross B is still going to be in the same direction. So E cross B is the direction of the energy flow. So if you really want to think about energy flow in an electromagnetic wave, it's a little bit different from sort of the ways in which we think about energy flow often in mechanics, where we may be heating something up or having it lose energy. Here, the energy flow actually has a direction. And so if we put that direction into the intensity, then we get something which is called the pointing vector. And it's not pointing vector in POI, but I always remember it that way. It tells you the direction of the energy flow. And it's given the symbol S, and it's E cross B over mu, so it is really the intensity of the light with the direction from it. Okay? And the absolute magnitude of this will vary with time. The intensity, for example, this is an instantaneous equation. And remember, in this electromagnetic wave, E and B are in sync. So we have E and B both at full amplitude. And then in time, they're both at zero, and then they're both at full amplitude again. So the intensity is actually going to vary over the period of the wave. Okay, it's going to vary sinusoidally. So you can imagine if you look at this in this box and you ask, how is the power going through this thing? How is the intensity changing? Instantaneously, remember, the electric field is going to go as some amplitude times a harmonic function, and B is going to go as that amplitude divided by C times the same harmonic function, just basically saying they're in phase. So S is going to go as
Here we have it as E times B, but if we now want to put it in terms of the amplitude of E and the amplitude of B, which is something that doesn't change as the wave is moving, right? The actual value of E and B both are changing, but the amplitude of the wave of each is not changing, then we can rewrite this S in terms of these two quantities, square one, and we get it in terms of the amplitude of E, for example. We could have put it in B if we wish. And then, this is a sine function that's harmonic in time, and we can time average. Instantaneous intensity is not generally that useful. I think if you're at LLE, you might worry about instantaneous intensity, because you might be worrying about instantaneous power to something. But generally, what you worry about it's time averaged intensity. So how much power is incident on a surface over a little bit of time. Anything that takes any time to do, you're going to time average over many of the wavelengths. So that's really the power you have to worry about so much. And remember that time average of a sine squared just is a factor of 1/2. So usually you worry about the average intensity, which is the average of the Poynting vector magnitude, and it goes as, you can put it in terms of E or you can put it in terms of B, and these are actually, this is the amplitude, which is a useful quantity that usually you can have more knowledge of than the instantaneous field at a given point. Any questions? Imagine what happens when an electromagnetic wave hits a free charged particle with charge plus Q. There will be a force on this charge instantaneously because it's a charged particle in an electric field. If it's just sitting here at the moment the wave hits it, it's not moving, so there's no magnetic force on it, in principle. But if there's an electric field on it, then it will start to move. If it begins to move and run the electric field, you'll also have a magnetic field. So let's think of it that way. Let's suppose the electric field basically gets it moving and you have a magnetic force on it. That magnetic force is going to go as QV cross B. And if you can imagine that this charge is moving along the electric field, and you look at, it's positive charge, the electric field is up, so it's going to begin to move in that direction. So B is that way, right? You curl it into B to get the direction of the force of the magnetic field, and you'll see that it's actually in the positive X direction. Okay? So the force will be in the x direction, and it'll be the x component of this b cross b term, which turns out to be this cross product piece. So this would be the i term for that cross product. There is no b component along the y, it's only along the z, so this term is zero. So this force goes as q b in the y times b in the z. And there is a relationship between the magnitude of B in the Z and E in the Y, so that's C. So this is the relationship between E and B within the electromagnetic wave. So we can rewrite this in terms of BY and EY. So I want to think a little bit about the force and work and things like that. Work goes as force dotted in the distance. And so this is Q times E times V if I divide and multiply by T.
take the derivative of this with respect to time. And you get basically Q E dot B. So this is sort of Q E dot B. Divided by C. So the force that we have up here, is this a power, right? It's the force is d momentum in with respect to time is going to be the power divided by C with respect to time. So this is a little bit weird. I don't know that it seems we're relating the force to the actual power in the wave. So we're, if you take out the time piece, then you get that the momentum, the change in the momentum of the wave varies with the amount of energy that goes through. So there's a relationship in an electromagnetic wave. May seem a little bit weird. Right? We haven't said anything about mass. But if you think of force as a change in momentum with respect to time, an electromagnetic wave can convey a force, and it can change with time. So electromagnetic waves, even though they have no mass, have a momentum. And that momentum goes basically as the energy divided by C. A little bit weird. We don't usually talk about the momentum in an electromagnetic wave when we start to worry about the P word, that other unmentionable P word that we'll get to. We will talk about momenta, but usually when we're talking about classical electromagnetic waves, we talk about a pressure. So if we assume, for example, that we have something that is, usually people say that if they want the wave to be completely absorbed, they say, suppose we have a black surface. So you can imagine for optical waves, you have no reflection off a black surface. So you're saying that it all gets absorbed. In that case, the force is dP over dt. If P is U over C, then this is dU over dt times 1 over C. This is power, okay? I divide by area and multiply by area so that I get an energy, I get a power, energy per time per area. And this is just the pointing vector. That's the intensity of the wave. So the force goes as the intensity times the area divided by C. And I divide through by the area, and we have a force per unit area, which is a pressure. And that is something that you talk about a lot with classical radiation. So the pressure goes as the intensity divided by C. And usually, of course, I mean, this is an instantaneous thing, so you can have instantaneous pressure. But remember that the intensity is varying very fast for an electromagnetic wave instantaneously. So it's usually the time average that's more important. So the time average pressure will go as the time average intensity divided by C. And the other trick to keep in mind is the basic idea that if you reflect the wave, the change in momentum will be twice, so the pressure will be twice as bad. So that, if that doesn't quite click. If you take a basketball and I throw a basketball at you and you grab it, right, the momentum of that basketball is transferred to you. Okay, so the force per unit time to you, the momentum that you have to grab. So the change in your momentum with respect to time is going to be the momentum of the basketball over that short time, right? If instead of catching it, you block it, then you're taking a basketball's momentum and reversing it. which means it's gonna, not only do you have to absorb its incoming momentum, you have to give it a momentum that way. So by momentum conservation, it means that the change in your momentum is gonna be twice what it was when you caught. Okay with that? Okay. So if you have a reflective surface, then the radiation pressure is going to be twice as much. So for any problem that you ever see that regards radiation pressure in sort of, you know, the basic physics class that you have, check to see whether it's reflective or not. If they say it's a black surface, you use this. If they say it's a reflective surface, you use the times two. Okay? Did you care? About radiation pressure in your life? Huh? Why? You might die. Yeah, I only ask it if it's a matter of life and death. That's true, but you may not have really thought about why. So why is it a matter of life and death, this whole radiation pressure thing? The energy still comes from the sun, so you can still grow corn and eat. Your MP3s will still work. The Xbox will still work. Why do you care? Have you ever thought about how stars work? No? What do you guys think about? Alright, so here's Astronomy 101 in a nutshell. So you start out with a bunch of interstellar gas, mostly hydrogen. Where it comes from is a different story. But I'm sure you could get me to tell you if you wanted to later, but not this class. And gravity happens, right? So if I have a little asymmetry in the mass, then I get a little bit more mass here than over here, so things will start to coalesce a little bit. And so if I have a gas and I begin to compress it, it gets hot, right? You ever notice that? Next time you have some sort of spray stuff, spray it and feel the nozzle. Whenever you do an adiabatic meaning there's no time for heat to flow, okay? So whenever you do an adiabatic expansion of a gas, by thermodynamics, it gets cold. You did thermodynamics in 121 or not? Yeah. Most of us hate crap, so we don't like teaching it. When I teach 129, 113, I always do fluids instead of thermodynamics, because that's what I hate thermodynamics. But it's actually really important stuff. So one of the things you find out is if you take the volume of gas and you expand its volume and you don't have time for heat to flow, the temperature of the gas will drop. Right? And in fact, even in fire extinguishers, certain types of carbon dioxide fire extinguishers, you have gas under pressure, you let it out, you get dry ice coming out. It gets so cold when it comes out that it literally freezes, so you get dry ice spouting out. So, at any rate, on the other way, next time you pump up a bicycle tire, if you pump the bicycle tire, you're doing it the other way around. You're compressing the gas adiabatically because you're doing it very fast. And if you feel the nozzle after you pump it for a minute, it's very hot. Right? So it's very cool. Well, one of the neat things about astronomy and astrophysics is crap that works here is the same stuff that works out there. And it's just hard to imagine. But I have this big gas cloud out in interstellar space, and gravity is slowly collapsing. It gets hot because it's an adiabatic compression of this gas. So it gets very hot. Well, if it's very hot, it's radiating infrared radiation is the way to think about it, which exerts pressure, which keeps it from collapsing. And you can get an equilibrium between the gravitational collapse and the radiation pressure pushing out. But because you're sitting out in the middle of interstellar space, it's hot, so it will radiate away some of its energy. And slowly, as it radiates away its energy, it's cooling, so there's less radiation pressure, so it collapses a bit more, right? And this process will continue and continue until it gets really, really hot in the middle of the sun. And it gets hot enough that you can actually initiate thermonuclear fusion. Right? The whole idea with thermonuclear fusion is that we'll talk about later in the term, but there's a force of nature called the strong nuclear force that is vastly stronger than the electromagnetic force. And we know that's true because if I take a nucleus that's made up of protons and neutrons, and you imagine the Coulomb force between the protons when they're 10 to the minus 15 meters apart, calculate it. I'll make you calculate it later in the term. It's vast and repulsive. And yet we know, for reasons we'll talk about later in the term, we know that the mass in an atom is pretty, and the protons and neutrons are all in a region which is a little ball about 10 to the minus 15 meters. So there has to be some force that it holds it together, and we call it strong nuclear force. And it turns out when you send electromagnetic probes into atoms and they get scattered, the scattering looks just like it's a Coulomb force until you have enough energy that this probe can approach this object to within 10 to the minus 15 meters. So I have enough energy that I can take two protons, basically, and shove them to where they're within 10 to the minus 15 meters apart. And when you do that, everything changes. So that's the range of this nuclear force. And it turns out that there are, if you can get nuclei and get them to within that range of each other, they'll initiate, they may initiate fusion reactions and release a lot of energy. So the reason that initiating fusion reactions is so hard is because it takes an enormous amount of energy to take these two things and get them that close. They may release more energy than that in the end, but you can't get them there. So LLE is trying to do that by taking pellets of stuff and blasting it with lasers from all sides, okay, to both compress it and make it energetic enough that you can begin to initiate fusion. In the sun, it happens by this adiabatic compression of the gas, which compresses the gas, one, which gets things closer together, but also makes it really hot. So when you make something hot, you're getting the each degree of freedom, 3/2 kT in energy. So you raise the temperature, you get more kinetic energy, which means as these things are bouncing around, they start to get close enough to initiate fusion. So what will happen in the star is you will slowly radiate away this energy, which is basically potential energy due to the gravitational collapse, until you get hot enough in the center and you begin to fuse the hydrogen. And then you get nuclear reactions happening in the center of the sun. And again, they push out and you will get an equilibrium between the gravitational force pulling in and the radiation pressure from the fusion reactions pushing out. So radiation pressure is the thing that stabilizes stars. Not strange Japanese birds, but stars. Stars. So that's why you care. Sorry. Okay. Any questions, comments, heartfelt feelings? Yes?
Does this pressure have anything to do with the formation of planets?
It has an enormous amount to do with the formation of planets. And if you want to understand galactic formation, stellar formation, and planetary formation, this becomes a really important issue. So, for example, you're collapsing this gas cloud due to its own gravitational. But as you do, you have to conserve angular momentum. So it's spinning. And the radiation pressure from the initial star will actually blow out a lot of the lighter gases. So, for example, we have very rocky cores in the inner part of the solar system, but the outer part, you have big gas planets because the radiation pressure really wasn't enough to blow that the life gas away out there, but in this close, it's hot enough and pressure's enough to effectively blow it out. So, yeah, I mean, to understand the dynamics of what stuff radiation pressure plays a role in.
So it's like Mercury
is getting more pressure, but also temperature has a lot to do with it. I mean, basically, you're getting, if you have a gravitational force holding things in on a planet, but if you give the atoms enough energy that they can overcome the escape velocity of the planet, they will vaporize and dissipate out into space, or go out far enough that then the radiation pressure may also play a role. Lots of effects. Yes?
So I have a question for this. Literally, a point being inverted by light.
It is literally a force being exerted by light. The intuition mechanical game that I play has to do with this. I found that it's useful to think about wiggling charges when you're trying to understand reflection and pressure aspects of electromagnetic waves. The extent of which that is super real, I'm not 100% sure, but I found that it's a nice mechanical picture in my mind. And one of the reasons I worry a little bit about how real it is just that you always have inertia in the system, right? And this wave's coming really fast, so it may be slightly more complicated than that, but I found that mental picture actually works very well. Generally. Yeah, there are even space probes that are used. You can use solar sails, right? You can put a big mylar sail and have the radiation pressure. I mean, it takes a little while, but it really works. Yes?
Is this kind of thing that you're talking about?
This how what?
The device used to measure radiation. Is this still something?
Okay, so radiation is this catch-all word. And so
that measures radiation.
Yeah. So we're gonna later in the term we're gonna talk about what we mean when we say radiation. So up till now we've talked about this electromagnetic light, electromagnetic radiation. And when we get to the P word, we'll discover that you can think of it as having particulate nature, and at very high energies. Sometimes these things are emitted by nuclei, where you have transitions between nucleons, between energy states, where the difference in those energy states might be millions of electron volts. And so the light that comes off when you do that has energies in millions of electron volts, and those are gamma rays. And that is one form of destructive radiation. But the essence of it is no different, except for the fact that it's high energy. It's no different from the regular photon that everybody's looking at all the time. In addition, when you get up to those kinds of energies, because we know E equals mc squared, sometimes the energy can manifest itself in terms of massive particles, like electrons or alpha particles, or something like that. When that happens, we also just call it radiation, but these beads have electric charge. So you detect light and you detect electric charge quite differently. So a Geiger counter, for example, is a wire inside a cylinder where you have a big voltage across them, and if you have a charged particle traverse that region, it gives you a little stream of ionization where the charged particle knocks electrons off of atoms, and because you have it in a high voltage, you drift it. If that voltage is high enough, you give those electrons enough energy that they also begin ionizing other atoms, and you'll basically get a big cascade of charge, which you can detect easily with your electronics. So that's sort of a typical Geiger counter. If you want to detect a gamma ray or electromagnetic radiation, you sort of have to, for gamma ray, you have something that effectively converts it into charged particles, which you then see. At lower energies, you have to do other things, usually. But almost always, you'll find, and I might even go so far as to say always, but I have to stop and think. We detect things by converting them to electromagnetic stuff, and then our neurons or the electronic circuit that we're dealing with can actually deal with it. But that's really step one in most processes, is whatever the hell it is, change it to electromagnetic, make it ionize something, and then you can see it. So.
What's the viewpoint?
Huh?
The
key word? That's a prep for And we'll get there. But right now, I mean, the real theme of this right now is these are waves. And I want no doubt in your mind, right? But that's what Maxwell says, and it works really well. And we're going to keep pounding at that because I'm going to talk a bit about polarization, and then what I'm hoping to do is to literally take Maxwell and derive a couple of basic optics laws. Right? And it's from that. This stuff is coming straight out of Maxwell, and it is pure waves. And I want that to be really strong in your mind, because when we mention the P word and we begin to think of these things having a particular nature, it is really weird. I mean, at a very deep level that you would have that, because these are waves. Okay? So that's why I'm a little hesitant to talk about the P word too much, but we'll get there. Okay, anything else on this? But that's why you care about radiation pressure. Okay. I'm going to make a subtle change here that you need to notice. What we have talked about for this transverse wave moving in the x direction, we have actually made a specification. We have said that the electric field is along the y-axis, right? If you really want to have a general solution for a transverse electromagnetic wave moving in the x direction, you have to allow for the fact that that's a special case, and that we have two orthogonal axes that we would have to have in the solution if we had any general thing. So for that, we have to allow the electric field to be oriented along the z. And if I have two pieces in the solution, one with the electric field along the y and one with it along the z, then I have an orthonormal basis set in NASD. And you can describe any orientation of that just by having different degrees, different amplitudes for the electric fields along the two directions. Right? You okay with that? So what that means is if I really want to have a general solution for an electromagnetic wave traveling in the x direction, here's what we looked at, right? Where the x is up and down, and here's my electric field. Is it orange here? It's in the up and down direction. For us to have a general solution, I have to add to that with some coefficient or whatever a component where the electric field is in and out of the plane, in and out of the board, like so. You okay with that? So now I'm going to start looking at just the electric field component, not the magnetic field component. Because the magnetic field components of these two orthogonal electromagnetic waves are basically given by E cross B, and the magnitude of B is E over C. They're in phase. E cross B gives you the direction of the wave. It's all sort of there. So I don't need to specify B. But if I want to understand the general solution, if I start drawing in B's as well as the E's, it's going to be so crazy we can't understand what's going on. So I'm going to use a basis where I have one wave with E polarized along X and one wave with E polarized along Y. And now what I'd like to do is to forget B altogether, and I want to look at a wave that is made up of these two orthogonal components of E, each of which does have its own B going on, in phase with it, etc. Okay? But these two pieces are orthogonal. You can think of them as different electromagnetic waves, if you wish. They could have different amplitudes, they could have different phases, because they're orthogonal. Okay? But each of them comes with a B.
Having said that, I'm now not drawing the B. So what you see here is a drawing of the electric field for one solution and the electric field for the other solution. You okay with that? In this case, I'm drawing them to have the same amplitude and to be in phase. That is, one of them goes as cosine kz minus omega. Oh, no, I didn't do that. This wave is actually going in the z direction, not the x direction. Sorry. I stole the picture from another point in my notes. We've been dealing with it going in the x all along. So now I'm having it going in the z. And that means E instead of oriented along the y and nothing along the z. And it moves in the x. I have it oriented along the x. Sorry about that. Just keep that in mind. But basically, here's our wave. It's now moving in the z. Therefore, this wave function, I'm saying that one component has the electric field oriented along the x, and it'll be a function of, you know, it goes kz minus omega t, so that's the wave that moves off in the z. It has some amplitude. The other orthogonal piece has the electric field oriented along the y-axis, it also moves in the z, and I have it set up so that these two have the same amplitude and the same phase. Okay? And now, what I'd like to do is to ask, if you had a little electric wave detector in your eye, I guess you do sort of, but if you say you could look at it instantaneously, and that wave is coming into your eye, what would you see? Because these are waves, remember electric fields exhibit superposition. So your eye does not see an electric field this way and an electric field that way. Right? What your eye sees is the vector sum of this electric field and that electric field. Right? Which gives you something at some 45 degree angle. So if you imagine what's happening as this envelope passes through your eye, say at this plane, what you're going to see is, remember, we have the electric field components, same amplitude, same phase, so it's sort of like the E and B thing we did earlier. They're changing like that. But now they add together. So these two add like that. And when they're like this, they add like that. And when they're zero, you get nothing. So what happens is you end up with the electric field doing this as it passes through your eye. You okay with that? Yes?
For these general solutions where there's two different orthogonal waves, would the pointing vector for them be the orthogonal resulting vector?
You could, yeah, I think you could add the E's and the B's together and find the pointing vector and work out. Yeah. But each of the one way to think of it is that each of them individually has the pointing vector to z cross b.
And then you could add that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So if you imagine what your eye sees as this wave passes through the plane of your eye, and you look at the superposition of the two independent electric fields, what you would see is the electric field vector doing this. And it would have this orientation because, remember, look at the way it's drawn on the board. Here's x, here's y. It's coming at you, so it looks like that. This is x, this is y. And the electric field is going to be doing that. You okay? Because the electric field vector just goes up and down the line, we call it linearly polarized light. It is true that each of these orthogonal solutions was also linearly polarized light. Okay, but the overall general sum of them is linearly polarized. Okay?
Now, imagine if I take
one of these orthogonal waves and I slip it by one pi. So I take, here's the first wave, it's exactly what we have. It's written as a cosine, just like we have. And now I take this other orthogonal solution and I just add a pi to it. That basically takes, remember, so the y piece, when it's in phase, is positive over here. Okay? I flip it by pi, it means this moves over there. Okay? Now, if you look at what your eyeball sees, what you'll see, instead of it going like that, you'll see it going like that. So instead of seeing this, we're going to see it go like that. So now if I take the x and the y and I point them to you, you see the resultant electric field doing this. It's again linearly polarized, but the angle of polarization has shifted by 45 degrees. I'm sorry, by 90 degrees. Okay? You happy with that? All right? Okay. Now the fun starts. Now instead of shifting it by pi, let's shift it by pi over 2. And now try to imagine what you're going to see as this corkscrew sort of beast goes through your eye. I'm going to start right here. No, let's start at this point of the wave. At this point of the wave, I have 0 in the up. And I have full amplitude in the y. The wave is traveling this way, okay? So as it travels into my eye, I'm first looking at this point. I'm looking a little bit over here. So now I have a little e up here and a little e here. Then I get to the point where I have 0 this way and full amplitude that way. Right? And then this goes down and that one goes out. And then this one goes down, and that one goes out. And this one goes like that. Okay? So it's a much harder dance to do. But look, the full amplitude of E is this way. Then it's this way. Then it's that way. Then it's this way. And if you look at the sum, the vector sum of these things, what you have is a vector E coming into your eye that... get the orientation right. That's literally doing this. It's going in a circle. Which is what is known as circular polarization. Okay? I could slip it pi over 2 the other way, and instead of going like that, it would go the other way. So, light that's doing this is different from light that's doing that. So one of them we call right-handed polarization, the other we call left-handed polarization. Okay. I find this is sort of hard to see, so I made something cool. I do this always at the end of class. Alright, so I have... what I have drawn here is exactly what we've been looking at, except it's now moving in the x. We have a plane. I now have E for one orthogonal solution and E for the other orthogonal solution with a variable phase. At the moment, the phase difference is 0. And what you have projected here is each of the electric field components plus their vector superposition, which is the purple thing, as they pass through the yellow plane. Okay?
If I change the phase angle by 90 degrees, I'm sorry, I want 180. Then I have linear polarization the other way. So that's the change by pi. If I do it by 90 degrees, you get the circular polarization. I can trace the tip of the vector, which sort of helps. This is almost circular. I can change the amplitudes, and I can get elliptical polarization by basically having one component have a stronger amplitude than the other. If I change the phase the other way, it'll rotate the other direction. It's okay. You can ooh and ah. It's very cool, isn't it? I'll put the link on the web and you can play with it, but I find that this is very useful for sort of learning how to think your way through polarization. So. Okay. We'll see you bright and early tomorrow morning.